You are listening to the OneOfUs.net Podcast Network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Do you love sci-fi, horror, and fantasy films? Then grab a badge for Otherworlds Film Festival, the country's premier sci-fi film festival. There'll be Q&As, panels, parties, and mixers. Rub elbows with up-and-coming and established filmmakers, as well as like-minded filmgoers. Come celebrate our 7th year, December 3rd through 6th, at the Galaxy Highland in Austin, Texas. Badges are now for sale at OtherworldsFilmFest.com. That's OtherworldsFilmFest.com.
It's just a jump to the left.
And then a step to the right.
With your hands on your hips.
Or somebody else's.
And bring your knees in tight. But it's a, pelvic thrust.
That really drives you insane. Let's watch Time Warp documentary part one again. I'll watch it again. I'm sorry. I didn't plan that. It didn't come out well. It's the best I could do on short notice on improv. Not my high point. I'm sure Mindy would have done it better, who is indeed an actor.
Indeed.
But we are here to talk about a thing that is called Time Warp, that does in fact reference the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which is, you know, really kind of beyond argument, the most cult movie of any cult movie that ever cult movied. I mean, it really kind of set the stage for everything and what people think of as cult films. And this documentary series, a series, mind you, there's going to be three of these things, feature-length films focusing on different aspects of cult films, called Time Warp, the greatest cult films of all time. Start with Rocky Horror Picture Show. This first one's called Midnight Madness. This is kind of more of the three chapters, the one that they didn't feel like things here fit firmly into a different category, I think.
It was like a hodgepodge, to be sure.
It was. It was kind of like, well, I can't figure out, because look at the next two that are coming out, because they're doing them once a month. And these are on, weirdly, not through, this feels like the sort of thing Shudder would do, but it's not. It's a VOD download thing. And I get it after seeing it, because this documentary is filled with big name people commenting and taking part in it, like fucking lousy with big name actors and directors and writers and stars. You're like, wow, this is kind of an impressive
like
lineup.
Busey.
Well, and Gary Busey, by the way, one of the highlights of watching this first.
I was going to save Gary Busey, and we've already brought him in. But yes, it was amazing.
Crazy Busey. But before talking about all-star lineups, let's look into all our all-star lineup. I'm Chris, of course. Thank you. And joining me is Mindy.
Hello.
And Harmony.
Oh, I quiver with anticipation.
Say it!
And Adrian on his first review for us.
Yep, and I've also never seen the Rocky Horror Picture Show, so sorry, guys.
He's a Rocky virgin.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
It's fine, Adrian. Like I was telling you before we started, do not watch the Rocky Horror Picture Show on home or on cable or anything like that. Don't do that.
Or alone.
Not even if people are coming to your house to do lines. It's not the same. You have to go to a midnight screening somewhere in the country, of which every city in the country has a theater. Well, not right this second, obviously, has a theater, generally speaking, that is playing the Rocky Horror Picture Show on a weekend night on midnight. In fact, it is the longest running theatrical release of all time by a significant margin.
Yeah, I don't think there's a weekend in Chicago that goes by without one of those.
That documentary really starts off strong right off the bat with launching into this, because there's no other way. I would have honestly kind of lost respect for this if it hadn't launched with Rocky Horror, which was a huge phenomenon in that it made zero money when it came out. And, you know, and it was an adaptation of a play by Richard O'Brien, who wrote, directed, starred, wrote all the songs. So moved to movie, the studio's kind of like, well, this is wacky, but like, we're going to, you know,
it feels weird as fuck.
It's a 70s thing, you know? You're like, okay, in the 70s, they tried all sorts of weird shit that got wide release. This bombed, but before you know it, it was popping up left and right. People were literally saying, this saved my theater. I could not have kept my little indie theater going if it wasn't for the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Because I could count on these midnight movies.
Knowing that every Friday and Saturday night, I would sell out the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And that's still true today of theaters who are like, there's a part in here where one, this distributor said he went up and talked to, the creators, like, thank you so much for putting that movie out because I would have gone out of business if it wasn't for you guys, quite frankly. And that's kind of amazing. And that's kind of the legend of midnight movies and what cult films are all about. Now, your results may vary as far as what you consider to be your personal favorites of cult films in the selection we see in this first film. I think all of these that I've seen are quite good. Weirdly, the Samuel Fuller film, The Naked Kiss, is the only one I have not encountered.
Oh, yeah, okay. I had not even heard about that movie when they brought it up.
Okay, Shock Corridor, I thought, was by far considered to be his, like, cult masterpiece. Like, one of the ones people always talk about in hushed tones. Like, yeah, that movie's insane. You should totally see the great black and white, gnar, batshit crazy guy who's sane, goes undercover at an insane asylum and goes insane. Like, yeah, it's a great movie. No, it was a Naked Kiss, one I never heard of. But when they start describing it, you're like, okay, I can kind of see why now you put this on the list.
I always have these really fond memories of seeing these types of movies, whether it was, you know, with friends at midnight showings or you discovered on your own or whatever. And I was in Rocky Horror Picture Show cast when I was like 16 and 17, which is, now that I think about it, I'm probably too young to be doing that. But it was like you said in the documentary, it was a safe space.
No, same with weird. Me. My parents who knew about it, who had seen it years and years earlier, knew how dirty it, filthy it was, still thought of it as like kind of innocent. Because it is kind of innocent.
It is. I mean, it's nowhere near as bad as some other things.
No, it is not. And when I was like 16, 17, we went every weekend for years. To years. Georgetown in D.C. to go see it with a crowd of people and to perform the roles. By the way, Adrian, you were saying you were a had never seen it. We called a virgin. We had a whole great strategy harmony worked out for that. On our walk from my friend's house, which was at the base of the Exorcist stairs, by the way, in Georgetown. Interestingly enough. We sit on the Exorcist stairs and get high. It was fun. But the walk from there to the theater, we would pass by this newspaper stand. You just put in a quarter for a newspaper and you grab as many as you want, basically. But it was a porn newspaper for just like hookers and stuff. So we would grab those and we would bring them in with us and we'd stand by the door. We'd always have people volunteer stand by the door and go like, people coming in, hey, welcome, be like really nice. Like, oh, it's so glad you're here. Have you been here before? Have you ever come to a Rocky Horror Picture Show? I think, do you know about the, because we use squirt guns, right? So we do this as a courtesy. If you've never seen this before, you want to take one of these newspapers. And then we knew who the virgins were.
Oh, nice.
Well, we've got to move on from Rocky Horror. We've talked about it a lot and talk about this actual documentary. Oh, there's so much. I could talk about the Rocky Horror for like hours and still never want to see it again. But I'll still listen to the soundtrack, but nonetheless. Yeah. So there's kind of a console group that's set up here that literally appears every once in a blue moon. The only
very rarely.
Like, the only criticism I have of this really is just that they set up this sort of like, oh, we are the Illuminati group of discussing cult movies, which are odd mix of people that they've chosen. You've got Joe Dante, John Waters, Ileana Douglas, and Kevin Pollak, who, by the way, says almost not a goddamn thing during the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I'm hoping he'll talk more in the other ones.
But I felt bad for Ileana Douglas.
She at least got a moment. Pollak is famous for being, next to Rich Hall, one of the best impressionists in the world. I'm like, seriously, you got nothing, dude?
I feel like the only person who, like, really made sense there was John Waters, and I thought he was great. Yeah. I mean, John Waters is kind of always great, but...
John Waters, like, arguably, well, I mean, definitely, it says Joe Dante was, like, the head of the panel, and it's partially, he runs a podcast now that's about kind of cult film stuff.
Oh, really?
So I guess that's why... But Waters was definitely the guy who was in charge here. I mean, he's John Waters. He's right. Love or hate his movies, you can't not love John Waters, the guy. Just going down the list of the movies this chooses, please. I know people are going to freak out because their favorite cult movie isn't here. Like, don't. All right. There's two more movies worth of cult films. And even then, I mean, my first reaction to all of this is like, boy, y'all went, as a cult movies list go, pretty goddamn mainstream. But that's
that
me.
That is true.
Because for me, most of these cult movies are mainstream. This is my childhood, you know?
Yeah.
But...
Well, I mean, you've got things like Big Lebowski. That I mean, that's Coen Brothers. That's totally mainstream.
But that is the film. That is like their, maybe their most financially successful film in terms of longest running. I mean, that movie constantly plays midnight movies and, mm-hmm. and there, it has its, it's the only one of the Coen Brothers movies that has its own festival just dedicated to that film. That kind of makes it a, the cultiest of the culty Coen Brothers films. But yeah, there's a dual Coffee and Foxy Brown just trying to go an all representative Pam Grier thing, but obviously well deserved. Right. Reefer Madness, which does a great job of sort of exploring, hey, this thing was originally put out by a group of Catholics who were trying to make this as an honest to God warning against people using marijuana. And then a producer got a hold of it and recut it, and it turned into, you know, the thing that it turned into eventually, a musical starring Kristen Bell. Freaks, the Todd Browning classic that he made right after he made Dracula, for fuck's sakes. And for my money, Freaks is about 100 times better than Dracula is.
Oh, absolutely.
Haven't seen it, but I've heard of it. And I know the Weeble Wobble bit. I've seen that on many a horror list of creepy moments.
Well, you should. What do you think one of us is named for?
Yep.
I would go as far as to say, in regards to older black and white horror movies that people might be avoiding for that reason, it was one of the easiest ones to watch. I thought Freaks was really enjoyable.
You'll race through that thing. It is, even by today's standards, it's shocking.
Yeah.
Like, and I don't mean in a like gross you out way. And I mean, it's just, these are honest to God, real, you know, I don't know what the terminology that's acceptable today, although I've been told Freaks is still acceptable by people who still do this sort of thing. Carnival Freaks, if you will. It's real life Carnival Freaks, and it's distressing to watch, but at no point is it casting these people in the role of anything less than their humanity. And it's fascinating.
Well, that's something the documentary points out, is they treated these people very respectfully. It's just, it feels like in the same way that American Horror Story hired, you know, like a lizard boy and a half woman and that sort of thing. It's like, we still see you as human. You just happened to physically be a character that we need. And this, that was happening in like, what, the 30s? Yeah, it was like even more of a progressive thing, because it's like, you don't look like quote unquote normal people, and yet I still see you as human.
Eraserhead, the David Lynch film that started the cult of David Lynch, which, man, hard call to say what David Lynch film is the most cult film, but Eraserhead is the one that started it all, and still, there's no explaining that film. You watch it and you're like, this doesn't make any sense, but as a character says in there, but there's like, says that, says it doesn't make any sense, but there's no question it has this real heart and center to it, and you understand it even as you don't understand it. Like, and that's true of a lot of David Lynch stuff, with the possible exception of Inland Empire. It's certainly not my favorite Lynch, but one that set the stage for everything else to come. Pink Flamingos, which we talked about briefly earlier, John Waters film. I remember my parents were weirdly super excited for me to see that film. I have no idea why. I'm from the East Coast, and everybody in, you know, Baltimore's right near there where Waters is from, so everyone's like, oh, John Waters, he's like this hometown hero right now. And that film is horrible. I mean, it's fucking
hard to watch.
I know I wouldn't be able to, because I love Ursula so much, and I don't want Ursula to be stained by this film.
I love Hairspray.
I feel like I'm a sellout for much preferring Hairspray over his earlier, like, Female Trouble and all that other stuff, where I'm like, this is just so gross. It makes me nauseous. It's so low budget. It's filmed like 16 millimeter cameras. It's just, or 8 millimeter at times. It's horrible. It has this huge cult of people around it who just watch it over and over and over again.
Oh, it was interesting to listen. That was one of the few times where the panel got to talk, and it was John Waters talking about lawsuits of obscenity. Yeah. And it was interesting to be like, after a while, it's just like, yes, because at 10 in the morning having to watch it, yes, in front of a jury. Yeah, it is totally obscene. Midnight showing when everyone's high and into it, no, it's fine. But yes, so I just ended up paying all the fines. Even when it was inducted into this museum of art or something, it's like, aha, we're art. No, just pay the fines. Just pay all the fines. Because they're right.
The next one is, I think, a flat-out masterpiece. 1971's Harold and Maude. Also a film that my parents made me watch. But this one, I went, yes, I totally see where this is coming from. And maybe it's their fault I turned into a total goth for a few years.
What happened.
Okay. Yeah, right? But Bud Cort is this kid from a rich family who's obsessed with death. And he's not really. He's just doing it to get attention from his totally distant, rich, pretentious mother. But he fakes elaborate, violent suicides all the time to try and get her attention. And he meets a 79-year-old woman named Maude, played Ruth Gordon, who is just totally in love with life. And this documentary does a really fascinating thing in that it goes to the basics and it calls attention to the most important thing to know about this movie. A scene where they're just hanging out and talking, watching the sunset. Then he looks down. It's just a flash for a second and it's never discussed again of seeing that she has a Holocaust
tattoo on
her arm. And that's just this incredibly vital moment of understanding. This woman has seen the worst that humanity has to offer, and she has chosen to embrace life in its fullest. And this sounds corny the way I'm describing it, except for the part for him trying to commit suicide violently all the time in a fake way. But trust me, it's fucking fantastic. And also, this is a movie that made me fall in love with the music of Cat Stevens, as I suspected it did an entire generation.
They mentioned in the documentary, it's like Cat Stevens is the third main actor in this film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
When they were talking about Hero and Maude, and that there's a really good moment where I forgot who it was exactly, but he's mentioning that moment and how effective it was. But that's where my problems with the documentary started, because right after that, it just cuts to Spinal Tap, and I feel like it kind of like lessens the effect of like, hey, this guy was saying something really nice, and now this is Spinal Tap. I don't know.
I didn't realize that there was a theme until you mentioned it was about midnight showings, and I'm like, oh, okay, that's the very loose theme that they put all of these films into. Because it goes into depth about what each of these films is, and it feels like as the movie goes on, it's like eating course after course of a banquet. And it's like, it's all delicious, but after a while you start to get really full and need to puke a little. So it's like, there's just, it's, you start getting, it's like, this is so much good food, but there's so much of it. Oh, yeah. I need to lie down.
I do like the fact that it's doing it in such short bites, because this is the perfect collection for right now. What have I not seen that I should have seen?
Yes.
And these are movies that don't necessarily show up on people's lists like that. They're like, these are all-time legendary classics that you may see and go, I fucking hated that. But you may see it and it may change your goddamn whole life for having seen it. Because that's the nature of cult films.
And I feel like that's why they have something like Big Lebowski. Because not only do they talk about the Big Lebowski, they have Jeff Bridges and John Turturro on to talk about it. So I feel like for the more, I don't know if casual viewer is the right word, but for someone who hasn't seen a lot of these movies, that's kind of like the draw-in. Like, oh, I do recognize this one. And now let me find out about all these other ones.
Them quoting their own lines in the movie, I don't think I've ever seen that before, ever. I was like, oh my God, I fanned myself a little as I had the vapors. they were quoting. And then I followed that up today by watching the Jesus Rolls, which is John Turturro's spinoff of The Big Lebowski, where about his character Jesus. So just saying. By the way, not actually a child molester. They clear that up right from the get-go.
Thanks for the clarification on that.
Good, thank you.
Yeah. Spinal Tap was the next movie. This is Spinal Tap. Rob Reiner's big shot across the bow of a film that will never die, that is both a mockumentary and actually kind of weirdly the beginning of a documentary about guys who continued to play music in a band for many decades after that as Spinal Tap.
And as a side note, they had their band from Mighty Wind open for Spinal Tap once, and the audience didn't realize that and booed them off stage.
That's fucking so perfect. There needs to be a new documentary just about that concert.
Yes.
But there's like two follow-up documentaries to Spinal Tap that were made for television. Like, even the Criterion Spinal Tap does not include those. And the Criterion Spinal Tap, which still needs to get a Blu-ray release, I can only assume they're trying to get rights for it, has them doing the commentary as their characters from Spinal Tap.
They had that for like the VHS copy. You could even, at one point they had, because this is how long ago I had the copy of this, because I got my dad the VHS, because my dad's a musician.
Next up, they had Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. That has 3 exclamation points in it, which I've always thought was amusing, and I was amused that the documentary pointed that out. Exactly. Russ Meyer's was this guy who was super easy to try and write off because all his films featured enormous breasted women who got naked through a lot of it, tons of sex, really silly softcore porn. And yet they were a lot better than that too, and influenced so many people. And this takes a look at his sort of big shot across the bow, which is Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which was deeply influential on a lot of people, including, of course, White Zombie. If you've ever listened to La Sexorcisto Devil Music Volume 1, it's samples from it fly rampant throughout the recording of that particular album. But it's kind of like, oh, here's this movie, and now it's just using it to talk about why people responded so positively to Russ Meyers. Kind of surprised they never got into Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which is the movie
that's coming up in one of the other ones.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Right. Well, he co-wrote it with Roger Ebert, who is a big film critic. And then famously, when they actually brought it on to the Siskel and Ebert show, and Siskel just trashed it. Of course. The next is The Decline of Western Civilization. I'm proud to say I own the Blu-ray box set of all three of the Decline of Western Civilization movies, thanks to my lovely wife. This was a very influential movie for young punk rock Chris Cox, as this was the generation of punk rock that affected my generation the most. It's the LA punk with bands like Fear and X and The Germs. And it was a documentary when no one was filming these guys. There's maybe two other records of the scene, and they're not even close to as comprehensive or good. Penelope Spheeris, who directed this, went on to do Wayne's World, amongst many other things. And Decline of Western Civilization is one of those films that not only is filled with some, if you like punk music, some really great, great music and really defining punk rock scenes, just a weirdly magnetic film to watch in and of itself.
I'll check it out.
I still want to see interviews. There's a bunch of people who are like just random teenage to early 20s punk rocker people who are all kind of obviously kind of fucked up, you know, like what goes like they show in here is like, I'm an alcoholic and laughs about it. You know, and like they're
all
like
director going, I didn't give them the heroin. I gave them the beer, but not the heroin. I just want to make that clear.
I brought the beer, not the drugs.
I want to see a follow up of that movie. Like what happened to all those kids that were there?
Well, they even mentioned that like some of the lead singers passed away like before the movie even came out.
Oh yeah. 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 The Germs, famously the lead singer died. If you watch the movie, there's a great sequence where they're talking about where they found a dead electrician in their backyard who had gone up to work on the wires and he died. So their reaction was first like, oh, we should call the police. They're like, well, let's take pictures with him first. It was very punk rock.
You know, in the documentary, they mentioned something like it was, it felt like it was passed around like contraband. Did you kind of feel that way when you first saw the movie?
Oh, most certainly. It was tape tradey, for sure. Like it was one of those you didn't get because you rented it from the store. You got it because somebody else had a copy and you bootlegged their copy of it.
Had a copy of a copy of a copy.
Yeah. Exactly. And you watched 1,000 fucking times, which is what we did. But like I said, thankfully, it's on Blu-ray now. Then we have John Carpenter's film, Assault on Precinct 13. Not his first film, but his first film to become a major hit. His film before this, Dark Star, went cult as fuck, but in a much smaller level. Assault on Precinct 13 is the one that is the reason John Carpenter became the guy who could make movies later on, like The Thing and They Live and Halloween and what have you. So many people have not remade it, but essentially remade it. Even this past year with VFW.
They remade it.
is a straight up remake of it. You are correct. Yeah. But that's not as good. But like this year, VFW is basically a old people doing being the people in the precinct. This is another great movie that everybody should see, and it still holds up. Am I the only one who's seen this of this crowd?
No, I love Assault on Precinct 13.
No, but watching this documentary, that's the one film where like I really want to see that one.
Kind of like that a lot of this documentary doesn't show the best part of the movie that they're talking about. Right. But I feel like they kind of dropped the ball on this one because they show a really shocking scene from Precinct 13. When I first saw the movie, I had no idea of it. I had never seen a trailer or anything like that. It was just like, let's watch a bunch of John Carpenter movies. And Chris, you know what I'm talking about. Well, you guys know what I'm talking about because you saw the documentary.
Yeah.
I've seen them all.
Yeah. So once that little girl gets shot, I was like totally shocked. And I wish that they just did not put that scene. Like, just let people watch it and feel that visceral feeling that I felt.
Yeah, but they did that because they had to talk about the ratings.
The little girl in question was the star of the Witch Mountain films, for the record. And which I was a huge fan of as a little kid, so I'm really glad I did not see this movie till I got much older, because I would have been like, no, 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 you cannot kill her. She would have killed you with her telekinetic powers before you got the chance. Next up is The Naked Kiss. We talked about this briefly. Samuel Fuller, who's like one of those directors who did a lot of movies within the feature film industry, but he's actually kind of better loved for his weird, this is my movie and no one can take away from me movies like The Naked Kiss and Shot Quarter that I mentioned earlier. I've not seen this. I look forward to seeing it. I got the impression none of y'all have seen this either. So we'll move on to The Warriors, who should come out to play.
They should come out and play.
They never come out and play.
They never come out to play.
You know, there's actually a video game based on
there
this.
There is a video
game. It's an amazing video game.
Yeah, there were two. There's a 2005 one for PlayStation 2 and Xbox. And then apparently there's the Warriors Street Brawl, which came out in 2009 for Mac and Windows and Xbox Live Arcade. I've not played the second one. I played the first one. But this was a Walter Hill film, who was another one of those directors who I would put like Walter Hill in the same category as Carpenter. He's completely one of those guys who is a commercial director whose best stuff is his cultiest stuff. A lot of fantastic movies in his history. And some of them are really good, like 48 Hours is a big commercial film by him. Mm-hmm. But some of his stuff like Southern Comfort and Last Man Standing with Bruce Willis, mm-hmm. these little culty ones that are like fantastic that are forgotten about. But The Warriors is one of his cultiest of all time films that has influenced so many people. And this is another movie that does huge midnight movie sellout regular repertory screenings.
Can you dig it, Chris? Can you?
I can.
Can you dig it?
I was able to go to one of those screenings at a movie theater that's like right by me, this old Chicago movie theater called the Logan Theater. And me and my friends, that's we all awesome. Dressed up as the orphans.
Oh, you chose to be the orphans? Of all the gangs in here, you went with the orphans.
It was the easiest to do on like a $20 budget.
I want to say my buddy Brian Salisbury dressed up as, I forget which ones were the baseball players one Halloween.
The Fury? What was
baseball that? Furies?
Yeah, the baseball Furies. But I mean, there's so many great ones in here. Like if I was young, I would have done the roller skating guys, but I couldn't do that now. I'd kill myself. But
I just love the fact that this is what they thought gangs were like.
I want my gangs to be in costumes or dancing, and that's it.
Maybe they were. I don't know. I wasn't like, I mean, I would go to, I went to New York in the 70s. We weren't in that part of New York. This is a great companion piece to Escape from New York. Watching that, this movie goes right next door to it. Like, this feels like a movie that could be happening in that same world almost. A last film they chose to do is Point Break. I thought for the longest time something was wrong with me for liking this movie as much as that I did. Because I loved the fuck out of this movie from the first time I saw it. I was like, holy shit, I know we're all supposed to think Keanu Reeves is like stupid and like we should make fun of him. And like Bill or whichever, I can't remember which Bill or Ted he played. That's basically who Keanu Reeves is.
Ted Theodore Esquire.
Yeah, exactly. No. And to be fair, he's not playing a guy who his performance screams Mensa here in this movie. I mean, no question Patrick Swayze is acting him out of the fucking room.
Well, of course.
Swayze had surprising depths considering he was a guy who'd never had any interest in being an actor until he was kind of thrust into it. This weird action movie by Kathryn Bigelow, who, of course, went on to do a lot of really great films, including The Widowmaker, Near Dark, The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, mm-hmm. Detroit. This was kind of a big early movie for her. At the time, she was married to James Cameron, who produced it for Keanu Reeves, who was kind of turning into a big star at this point. Gary Busey, who mystifyingly, I know it's weird to think now, was a star. Patrick Swayze was really having a huge moment right around this time, of course. He was a huge sex symbol. And what was weird about this movie was you didn't know how to feel about the setup. It was like the hero is like all clean-cut American guy who's being drawn into this world going undercover of these people who are like criminals. But man, they're fucking cool and shit.
Let's go catch a wave or whatever it was.
They weren't my crowd. I wasn't a surfer, but there's no, you watch it and you go, if you had a choice to hang out with the FBI and these guys, I'd pick these guys.
Hands down, yep.
If there's time. One movie in this documentary where I thought I have to see this because I've never seen it, it's Point Break.
Get off this right now. You gotta go. No.
All right, see you guys. I'm gonna go watch it.
No.
And it's got Lori Petty as the love interest, who was Tank Girl, who should have been.
Yes, Tank Girl so should have been in one of these lists.
Agreed. Absolutely. Well, that is the list of the movies in this first volume. We will be covering once a month all three of the volumes and talking about all those separate films. Before we go to everybody's final thoughts, I know you all still have a lot more to say in your final thoughts, and that's fine. There's a couple quotes I pulled out here I wanted to say. I love this one from John Waters, who says, "A cult film means that 20 people that were smarter than Hollywood executives liked it, and it lost a lot of money." That's what that means to Hollywood executives. Yes. And then Joe Dante, who the podcast in question was The Movies That Made Me, and he founded A Trailers from Hell, the website, says, "It means the definition of a cult film continues to evolve. Quote, the whole idea of a cult film is that a certain number of people in the know chuckle with each other that the world at large doesn't appreciate the same things they do, and that's too bad for everyone else. But now entertainment is so bifurcated and there's so many places to see things, it becomes much more difficult to become a cult movie." I think that's pretty dead on. Well, let's go to final thoughts, and we're going to start with Mindy. What do you think, Mindy? What are your final thoughts?
I liked all the information. And while it was condensed, it did give a good general feel about what the core was for each of these films, or in some cases, subcategories of films. Kind of felt like an overload at times. When I'm watching a documentary, I need to know the why. You know, why was this relevant? What was the effect that this had on the world, and what was the effect that the world had on it? The films are put together in a way that's very hodgepodge. You have something that's very recent next to something that's from the 30s, and it's just like, if they were more, I think, condensed into like subcategories like they did with the blaxploitation films and explained like, well, these things were important because of their influence on the black community. The section on blaxploitation films I felt was a great example of like, this is what I want in a documentary. But a lot of the other films didn't do that. It was just, this is the film and this is what it's about. Let's move on. And so because of that, it felt like just info overload with no application as to the why. But that said, it was a lot of interesting information, and it was very clear that everybody who was talking about them loved these films. They loved these films. They loved what they represented, and that was just joyful. 8.5 sweet transvestites from Transylvania. Ahaha.
What about you, Harmony?
I really enjoyed this. This is almost like coming home, you know, like that kind of feeling like, oh, I remember seeing this. Oh, I remember when I discovered this. And I was looking for something a little bit more when I got legitimately excited to see Gary Busey. I was like, oh, this is a nice change of pace.
His segment is like, wacky. Oh, this is nice. that guy has lost his goddamn mind. And that segment lets him just go.
An hour and 45 minute long documentary, and that's, you know, kind of the last 10 minutes of it. It's very conflicted because it's a lot of information, like Mindy said. None of it was done in like an exceptionally unique way. Was it fun? Absolutely. Was it like amazing? Probably not. So I would give this 7.4 poodle turds out of 8.
Adrian, what would you like to say about this film for your final thoughts?
So I thought it was pretty entertaining, and I mean this in the best way when I say that it feels like a bunch of little vignettes of IMDb trivia. Hey, we're going to talk about the Warriors. Did you know that Ronald Reagan called Michael Beck to tell him that he liked the movie? It would be like stuff like that. And I think it's the perfect type of documentary to reel in people who don't know that much about cult films, who maybe even don't know the definition of a cult film. And I like that they kind of expand on that, that it's a fluid word. It's always changing. Not really big on the structure of it. I was really liking hearing about Harold and Maude, and I didn't feel like something like Spinal Tap was the perfect next film to go into. And then after Spinal Tap, they went into something like The Naked Kiss. So it seemed like they had a list of cult classic movies that they forgot to put in a certain order. But I still really enjoyed watching it. I thought some of the interviews were great. They have some really big names in here. And they also have every actor and actress who you're like, I know I've seen them somewhere. Like, they have some really great character actors.
For a movie that comes from a relatively unknown director-producer who's, like, been sort of backyard on a bunch of stuff, but nothing anything big, it's a huge list of actors, writers, directors, and just people who are fans of these movies who are big-name people to this come in and gets, talk. Yeah. I was startled by how many people they got and how honest they were.
For sure. I would definitely recommend people see this. Especially if you're more of like a casual movie watcher who maybe wants to get into watching cult films and midnight movies. Not something that I would frequently revisit. I would give it 3 Jeff Goldblums appearing and me going, oh shit, it's Jeff Goldblum, out of 5.
I found this really kind of a great primer for people. And I've seen a lot of, I've read a lot of books that are cult films or some variation on that title to give you the idea. This is the movies you should be watching if you don't know anything about this stuff. I've seen a lot of documentaries that have tried to attempt this. This is the best out of any of the documentaries I've seen for this, certainly. Even with it just being the first one of 3, I'd still go, look, if you're one of those people, if you're like, as we used to say derogatorily, a pink boy or a normal, you're interested in expanding into like, I want to know more about these crazy films that people like, that people consider the best of the crazy films, before you take a deep dive into, you know, the Black Lodge with me and start exploring the real heavy stuff, give me a call, you know. I'll let you know. This is a great primer for that. It's very well put together. It is a little haphazard in terms of, like, there seems to be no order to which ones they pick to go.
Right.
But at the same time, it didn't seem wildly relevant either. I was like, does it matter? Like, I mean, especially when it's the first one of 3 documentaries. If they had put order, it would have felt more like VH1 product. Like, the big number flashes on the screen. Number 15! Eraserhead! I don't know. It just didn't feel like it even needed it, per se. I would love to ask the people in charge, how did you decide the order to put this in? Even though I've seen almost everything on here, and most of it multiple times, I still enjoyed watching the recaps. They're all just short enough to make you not tired of them talking about them if you already know everything there is to know about those films, but enough to give you a taste of why this might be something that's totally up your alley. I think this is something that anybody who has ever been had a big question mark on what should I see that I haven't seen yet should watch this. And arguably the next 2, we're not going to know till we talk about those in future reviews once a month, coming up in our new series, Time Warp, the 3 documentaries on oneofus.net, because that's how they're doing it. I don't know. Anyway,
the podcast about the cults.
Yeah, I'm going to give this 8 out of 10 amplifiers that turn up to 11 that
nice.
Quite frankly startled no one else chose, but I ran in excitedly to tell my wife this and she was like, duh, you didn't know that? And I was like, no, I didn't know that. Why are you so mean? Sorry, a little
wait,
bit too
you didn't
much
know
information.
Turn up from to 11 is from Spinal Tap?
No, I didn't know that. Tesla's
yep.
The car, Tesla's cars, both the radio and the air conditioning set
go
their highest setting
11.
At 11 because his Elon Musk's favorite movie is Spinal Tap. I did not know that. And they confirm it in this. He's like, yeah, Elon Musk excitedly had Rob Reiner sitting in his first Tesla and say, look, see, it goes up to 11. So confirmed.